This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
I owe you nothing!
It's just money.
This is madness! Everybody just yells and screams at each other. Nobody's civil anymore!
That's not the kind of humor we do on this show.
Put that coffee down.
I drink your milkshake.
Now you're looking for the secret.
There can be only one.
Everything becomes chaos.
Can you dig it?
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness. John Kutzmita and my friend here, Brent Johnson. We welcome you to the show. It's been an interesting couple weeks, and we're going to do our best to shine some light on what's happened since last episode. Brent, what's on your mind? What do you want to chat about here first?
Well, I think what we have to talk about for sure is the fantastic Super Bowl win by the Kansas City Chiefs. I know that you were very excited about that outcome. It was a very well-refereed game. You know, everything happened the way it was supposed to. And for once, we had an outcome that was supposed to be the way it was supposed to. Gotcha. No manipulation, no interference. And there was interference, I guess, is the right way to say it. Anyway, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you want my thoughts on the Super Bowl? As a Philadelphian and an Eagles fan, I'm not going to do what most people are doing in Philadelphia as they're trying to cope. I will say this. The game felt very unentertaining to me. The first half was all Philly, and it was like these long 8-minute drives. And then the entire second half was Kansas City, and it felt like a lot of sloppy play. It just didn't feel like the pinnacle of the NFL season. And the Eagles' defense was very disappointing. There was a couple big plays in the red zone where Mahomes literally could have picked two wide open receivers on either side of the end zone. So stuff like that just kind of like it felt like it let the air out of the balloon. That field goal at the end wasn't like, oh my God, they took it to the wire. Yeah. They're kicking the field goal to win it. It was just kind of like, wah, wah.
Well, I tend to agree with your assessment. Like the first half wasn't going so good for the Chiefs. The second half went pretty well for the Chiefs, but it wasn't really exciting until I would say from the 8-minute mark to the 1-minute mark was pretty exciting. But the last minute, it was very anticlimactic, like you said, you know, kicking the field goal. And then, you know, it was, I tend to agree with you. I was happy with the result, but the game itself wasn't super exciting. At least I didn't think so. But what my favorite part of the Super Bowl was seeing the video where they were interviewing Kansas City residents and Philadelphia residents, and they would ask a Kansas City guy, what are you going to do if you win? Oh, I'm probably going to go drink a beer. And they asked the Philly resident, what are you going to do if you win? Oh, we're probably going to go smash a few cars and set a house on fire. And, you know, it was and now your thing in the background falls down. That was my favorite part. It was just hilarious. It just shows the dichotomy between Kansas City and Philadelphia. You know what it reminded me of? You know what it reminded me of? When I was in college, I was doing an internship in Washington, D.C. And I went and watched, it was when Pulp Fiction came out. And I went and watched Pulp Fiction in the theater in Washington, D.C. And when the guy got shot in the back of the car, everybody in D.C. laughed. It was like hilarious. It was like this shock, hilarious thing. And so when I went back to Kansas City, I went and I watched it again with my girlfriend and her brother in the theaters. And when that happened, nobody did anything. It was like stunned silence. Nobody thought it was funny. It was the dichotomy between the East Coast and the Midwest is something to behold.
Yeah, I think the dichotomy of Philadelphia sports fans and everybody else, I think if you're not from Philly, you're appalled by the behavior. The greasing of light poles is something they're oddly proud of, and everyone else is just like beside themselves with. So I think that's it's a good example of kind of what we're seeing in the market right now. There's the huge dichotomy between bears and bulls. The economic data doesn't really give you a lot of confidence, but man, the markets clearly trade on something different than what the economy is telling us, or at least it seems that way.
Well, what's been really interesting for me is, you know, as we've said on the show before, I was kind of expecting a little bit of a rally at the beginning of the year, and I thought it would last to mid to end of January, and then I thought we would have a pretty hard pullback, or I thought that the pullback would start. And what's interesting for me is it did kind of peak at the end of January, kind of first very, very early part of February with the Fed meeting. And then for the last 2 weeks, I would say it's what I would call gone violently sideways. And what I mean by that is there's been big swings up and there's been big swings down, but it's basically gone sideways over those two periods. Every rally gets sold over the last 2 weeks and every dip gets bought over the last 2 weeks. And you know, the market's really, I think, struggling to figure out with what comes next. We've had some, you know, some of the inflation print came in a little hot. The PPI came in a little bit hot. Some of the data came in what you would call hawkish, but not so extraordinarily hawkish that it's convinced the market that the Fed is going to, you know, reaccelerate the pace of hikes. And so I think there's a real tug of war going on right now. You know, we've talked about this before. There was a big short covering rally at the beginning of the year. A lot of the short covering is gone now, but there's also not a huge amount of sellers that are showing up yet either. And every time the sellers do show up, it seems like the buyers come in and overpower them. Now, we had another pretty hard sell-off here into the close. This is Thursday. It's going to be really interesting what happens tomorrow with all these, you know, one day till expiration options. We're going into a Friday. It's the monthlies as well. So I think tomorrow could be a very interesting day in the markets, and maybe it will actually set the tone for what happens over the rest of the month.
Look, pulling straight from your memory bank, the number of times that I've read hyperbolic articles about option expiration and these, it's never a terminal event. It's never this climactic thing. So is this really something, is it just something we constantly always talk about or are we too much attention on?
Listen, it's a great question. And the answer, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. What I do know, and I know we've talked about this, and the reason I bring it up all the time is because it is true. Like, the market is really impacted by passive now. And I know I've said it again before, and I'm going to say it again. You know, if you're not familiar with the changing market structure and the way passive affects it, then you need to understand, because it's completely different than it was, you know, 15 years ago. And, you know, once a trend gets in place, it's really hard to turn that trend. But once it turns, then it's hard to turn it back. So if the rally that we've seen year to date is because of new funds coming in, you know, New Year's flows, people added into their 401ks. And if those flows stop and now sellers show up and there's not any new buyers, you know, if it turns, it could turn hard and it could turn hard quick. Now, I don't know whether it's going to turn hard and turn hard quick. I just know that based on the structure of the market and with these options and with the number of options, and it forces dealers to then either go in and buy or sell to match with whatever's going on with the options. If it actually turns the market, you could end up having kind of a crazy event. So, but like you said, a lot of times it never comes to pass, but the one time it does, you're going to wish you were ready for it.
It's the flows, bro. So passive is become a big thing. Ironically, the first time you and I met in Cayman, you know, it was one of the early reveals of Mike Green's work on the idea of passive. Yep. And that presentation still sticks in my head with the swinging pendulum. And, you know, that's been years. So he's just done. There's just so much material out on that. So, you know, people can go find that if they don't know Mike or his work on the whole passive active comparison. But you have to think that the Fed also knows this. So it's like they're kind of punching in the dark, right? Like, the whole goal of the rate hikes and, you know, calming the animal spirits and bringing down inflation, they're kind of fighting against this really strong riptide. Is that part of the reason why I think so many pundits think that, you know, that they're going to just keep going until they break something, because it's the only thing they can do when you have this huge passive momentum.
Well, I think it's a little bit of that, and then there's the Treasury part of it. And so, you know, I think last year the Fed was fairly very consistent. They said every meeting, inflation is too high, we're going to raise, and there may be pain involved. And they said that again and again and again, and they kept saying we're going to be data dependent. And the data came in hawkish, and they raised, and they kept doing it. And I will say that while they have maintained the same narrative, if you want to call it that, or the same glide path, there's no doubt that since November, they have, you know, I guess telegraphed that they are now slowing down. The path is the same, but they are now slowing down. And then the tone with which Powell and even some of the other speakers would talk, in my opinion, didn't match the words of the statements. And so I think when they've kind of started to change the speed of the path, not necessarily they haven't changed the path, but changing the speed of the path, and then kind of the contradiction between the words of the statements and the way they've said them and, you know, their body tone, I think that has led people to question things. And then also around November, the Treasury, as we approach the debt ceiling, the Treasury cannot issue as many bonds. And so, you know, Yellen has started spending the cash that's in the Treasury at a faster rate than she's issuing bonds. And so that provides net liquidity to the market. And so there's this big question, well, are they really tightening or are they not tightening? You know, the Fed's tightening, but the Treasury is loosening or providing liquidity. Which one is going to win out? So I think all of that, even though the Fed has remained fairly consistent, that combined with market action, which it's very hard to fight the market action, which continues to, which has remained fairly positive, I think it's causing a lot of people to be, you know, confused, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. So before the last couple pressers or meetings or announcements, as you were saying, the messaging was pretty clear. And we were kind of talking about this the other day or earlier, the overall tone you had suggested of Powell has been hawkish. And my kind of response to that, my conjecture is that, is he really hawkish as a central banker, or is he put in a position where you've got 40-year high inflation? Like, what else is the guy going to do? Even if he's a dove, you know, the house is already on fire. Like, you know, clearly you're going to at least pretend to get a bucket.
Yeah. I think that's a very important point that we should discuss. And we may have touched on this before, so if we're repeating ourselves, you know, I apologize, but I think it's really important to understand. I think a lot of people who've kind of followed monetary history, they know that when governments get in trouble, the playbook is to inflate away the debt, okay? So the bottom line is the Fed does want inflation, right? The system is designed to have some inflation. The system is not designed for deflation. Deflation actually kills the system itself. The system has to grow. It's designed to grow. And if it grows, then there's inflation involved. And so they absolutely want inflation. But what they do not want is runaway double-digit inflation. And the reason they don't want that is because that causes all kinds of political problems, societal problems. And that's when the pitchforks come out, for lack of a better word. And that's why, you know, a couple of years ago when everybody said they're never going to stop sending checks, they're never going to stop QE, and, you know, it's just going to print forever. It makes a lot of sense on a spreadsheet to do that. You inflate away the debt over 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you know, 10% inflation. Well, politically, that's just not acceptable. And so now they have to dial it back in. So I think what they would love is 4% inflation. They say they want 2. They really probably want 6, but they would love 4, right? Because that gets them out of the hole. You know, if you have if they could get 4% consistent inflation, I think if that were offered to them by a genie out of a lamp, I think they would take it in a heartbeat. Because over 10 years, you get rid of almost half the debt, right? But it's just very, very hard to get steady and consistent inflation. It's kind of like the whole, you know, the ketchup bottle, right? You shake it and you shake it and you shake it, trying to get a little bit of ketchup out of it, and then the whole thing comes out all over your plate. And that's kind of what happened with inflation, you know, in 2020 and 2021. And so now they're trying to put the ketchup back in the bottle, and it's not as easy to do as they'd like.
Well, it's funny using that ketchup analogy, because there's always these unproductive theories of how to get the ketchup out. Like you just hit the 57 in the right spot. And so it's a good example of monetary policy. Cause it's like, oh, we're just going to, you know, touch the economy in just the right spot and everything will be Goldilocks. But the, you know, one of the things to keep in mind too, with this theory of what the Fed really wants from a inflation percentage, an annual rate of change, let's say it's 4%. Well, do you think the economy can maintain real rates at that? Because right now, that's a huge advantage, especially for big money managers. You're seeing real rates come up, and you know, on the entire yield curve, pick your bond, you're getting 4.5%.
Yeah. So in the long term, no, I don't think it can support it. I think the debt has gotten to a level that it can't for a long, it cannot for a sustained long time handle these higher real rates. I think it will cause dislocations. The interesting thing though, and I'm just going to make this caveat, and it doesn't mean that I know the answer, but I will just say that I don't know if enough people have thought about this, is over the last 10 years, the banks, and especially even since COVID, you know, with all the QE that was done and the reserves that they received, I mean, the banks are in, at least the U.S. banks are in fairly good position right now. They're fairly well capitalized. And so the longer this can go on without a banking crisis or without a severe credit contraction, the higher rates is actually stimulative for the economy. And what I mean by that is if credit is not contracting, maybe it's not growing dramatically, but as long as it's not contracting and causing a credit contraction or a crisis, the higher rates means that the Fed is pushing more money into the economy in the form of interest payments on the bonds and the T-bills and, you know, the fixed income instruments that are now receiving higher rates. And so that provides at least a little bit more liquidity than there was a couple of years ago. I mean, you think about it. How many years did you go to a conference or did you listen to a podcast or did you read an article about the reach for yield? You had to go all the way out like 8 years to get to 2% yield on your investment. Well, now you can go out 1 year and get 4.5%. That's incredible. That's an amazing change. And we've gotten to the point now where a lot of like the big pension funds, the big endowments, these big asset allocators who, you know, they're trying to match their returns with their liabilities, and you know, in their pension schemes, maybe they're targeting 7% a year or whatever it is. And it used to be that they had to go way out on the yield curve to try to meet these, you know, interest payments. Well, now they can park their money in 1 or 2 year treasuries, get 4 or 5%. They're never going to get fired for owning treasuries. It's the risk-free rate, for God's sakes. And they're pretty close to their mandate. And that's a big change for the market. And that's another reason why I think stocks may struggle in the short term, is because they now have competition. For a long time, there was no competition. Right? There was no alternative, right? Tina. How many times have we heard Tina? There's no alternative. But now T-bills paying 4.5%, that's not a bad deal.
Well, what's the saying? Nature abhors a vacuum. You know, there's this idea that you're presenting here. Okay, so now really large capital can kind of park itself and hang out. That ultimately has a knock-on effect someplace else because they're not going further out on the risk curve, right? They're not investing in high yield or some other types of things that were benefiting from liquidity. And so it's the Fed, there is no static environment where they win. Right. And I think that's really the debate here with an idea of a soft landing or hard landing. Like something's going to give. Have they made enough progress? Is the, for example, like you were saying, the banking market well capitalized so that when the ripple does come, it's not an earthquake like we just saw in Turkey. You know, it's something more manageable and it doesn't bring down the system. I will add a quick note in terms of the banks being, you know, healthy or well capitalized. That has a lot to do with what you just said about real yields and even just the bond curve in general. Well, one of the things I recall back in 2009 in the housing crisis, and you had all these toxic loans and banks trying to get rid of this stuff. I was doing a lot of negotiations with smaller community banks trying to buy these distressed REOs at obnoxious discounts, where the big guys like the Wells Fargos and the BOAs, you know, they were able to take way deeper discounts, offload all the crap in bulk, and still maintain, you know, reserve requirements, liquidity requirements. It's the small community banks that don't have that flexibility. And then they're sitting there trying to nickel and dime a toxic asset at a 10% discount when the market's trading, you know, in a five handle. So, or at a 50% discount. So you've got a situation here now where you're starting to see outflows from bank deposits in the smaller community sense, because people are like, well, you're giving me zero in my savings and I can go buy a 2-year treasury. So there's no real concrete point I'm making there other than that you always have this ebb and flow. And when it looks like one thing is nice and healthy, you kind of overlook the smaller guy in the room that is actually struggling to, you know, hit their mandates.
Yep. So it's kind of a brave new world right now, a brave new world can be very exciting, but can also be very dangerous. So it's really going to, I think we're going to have an inflection point sometime in the next month, if not sooner. But, you know, I've been saying that for a month and a half now and we haven't had it. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. You know, there is one thing I want to make sure I touch on this before I leave, because this just, you know, this whole show is called Milkshakes, Market and Madness. And a lot of times we talk about the madness with Twitter, and I just had to laugh this morning. There was some guy I was talking with on Twitter, and we were talking about the balloon that got shot down last week. And I actually was curious. You know, I even asked myself, why are they shooting a missile at this balloon? Why aren't they just shooting a hole in it with a bullet and letting it collapse? Well, there's actually a reason why they don't, and that is because at very high altitudes, if you shoot a balloon full of holes, the air pressure is not significant enough to deflate the balloon to make it then crash. And this actually happened, you know, like 20 years ago with a Canadian weather balloon that was off track, and they tried to shoot it down with bullets and cannons, and it didn't work. They filled it full of holes and it just kept floating. And so that's actually the reason that they use a missile. But I was having this discussion with somebody on Twitter today, of course, an anonymous account. And they said, well, you know, they didn't have to use a missile. And I said, well, actually they did. And I said, but I'm sure you'll argue with me, because I'm sure you're an expert on aeronautics, aviation, and weapon systems. And he came back and he said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. I was like, of course you are. Of course you are. Twitter. There's an expert for everything on Twitter. Anyway, I just had to laugh at that one. That was one of the best ones I've heard for a while.
And the most obscure experts are always under the most obscure anonymous. Profiles as well. Well, look, before we wrap up, I think it's worth noting, while we're on the topic of balloons, The Economist, which is a bit of a piece of comedy and FinTwit in the economic world, it's always a contrarian indicator. No matter what they say, the opposite tends to happen. They just came out with a cover that says why inflation will be hard to bring down, and there's a balloon with a nail going through it. So
kiss of death. Deflation tomorrow.
For tomorrow. All right, man. Hey, I appreciate you hopping on. It was a good chat. We covered quite a bit. We'll have more for everyone next week, and let's see what happens with this violent sideways battle that's going on. Maybe we'll get a winner next week. Thanks, Brent. I appreciate it.
All right, man. Peace.
Talk to you soon.